Hello, I'm Paul Kitkat.
And I'm Chalice Croak.
This is the next podcast in our series, 168 Things We've Learned About Creative Marketing and We Think You'll Find Useful to Know. We're recording these in our home studios, so we are socially distant, but mentally present. Please excuse any stray noises you might hear, given the setup that we're using, or any oddness in the sound quality. Okay, enjoy the podcast. My guest this morning is Mark Knorr, my business partner for many years. We no longer work together. I'm doing this and you are now. Can you tell me what your fantastic job title is now?
Yes, I'm Group CEO of Miramar Agencies, which is a global marketing services group. I also happen to be chairman of one of its agencies, which is Fold 7, the advertising agency I went to work at after KitKat Knorr.
We both started in direct. You now are obviously a titan of advertising.
And don't know about that, but go on.
Well, we'll talk about maybe the contrast between those two. But let's start with something else. How to open doors and how to get prospects to talk to you and invite you then to pitch or just to appoint you. What are the secrets that you've learned about that along the way?
Oh, you know, Paul, I don't know if there are any secrets. And it's not as if at KitKat Knorr we had the world's most advanced targeting system with the best tech platform, etc. But I think we got the fundamentals very right. First of all, we loved doing it. And I think like any team, any practitioner, you can tell if someone enjoys what they're doing. We absolutely loved pitching and we were really good at it. Took a while. In our first year, we didn't win anything. But then I think you remember we then won something like our next 15 pitches and kind of were a bit of an unstoppable force as a team. So what are those fundamentals? I think the first thing really is the one I've mentioned already, enthusiasm, passion. We just loved doing it and people could tell. We also clearly developed expertise at it. But perhaps more importantly, when it comes to expertise, I don't know if any client wants to be pitched at by a pitch expert. I think what they want to meet is an expert in their domain. And we had expertise in our respective domains. I think that we were also a very good team. It was an early observation of at least one of our investors that the characters, the people who were KitKat Knorr, Alexander and Shaw, were really different. Additional people that we hired to pitch with us over time. Very different characters, different source of expertise. I think we showed insight and intelligence at our best too. We didn't always do great prospect meetings or indeed pitches, but at our best, we fundamentally understood the brands we were talking to. We understood what their customers wanted. We showed great insight and intelligence, and there isn't a client in the world that doesn't want that. You know, it's an oversupplied market. Everybody's hounding clients, trying to kind of get on their radar. So if they do meet someone, they want that person or those people to have insight, intelligence, to have something to say. And I think at our best, we did all of those things. And I think over time, and here is, I think, a verity of prospecting or a truth, an eternal truth. We had a brand. You know, people wanted to work with us because we were the people that Waitrose and John Lewis and Starbucks and Toyota and Lexus. And so the list went on chose. So clearly there was something in it and that work was well regarded. And so, you know, like any brand, you develop a reputation and hopefully some of that reputation precedes you.
The great truth about agents is that they're defined by their clients. Prospects look at your client list and that's how they see you through that lens. So by the time we had the clients that you've just named, of course we were desirable. Who wouldn't want to work with the agency that's already got those names on its list? It's a great list to be part of. But I'm also reminded, listening to you, that right at the start, when we first set up, of course we didn't have those names there. But what I do remember is that I used to, by the time I arrived at the agency in the morning, you had typically made about 200 phone calls. I would arrive and you'd say, well, I've got us a meeting on such and such a day and we're going to go down to wherever it was. And
actually, it's all flooding back. I did make lots of phone calls. You're absolutely right. I'd read in a book somewhere, I think, that, you know, in sales, you should make a prospect call a day, even if you're, you make it to the heady heights of the boardroom. You should make that prospect one prospect call a day, because partly it's a numbers game and also because it keeps you sharp. So we did lots of that. We did lots of train journeys. We kissed lots of frogs. I recall us, you know, getting great meetings with that amazing marketing director from that great brand, only to find that we had a 4-hour journey and there is the junior executive came to meet us for a coffee and they were about 10 years old. And we had to pitch them our credentials. We also had some disastrous speed datings. We did a couple of speed dating events, where you'd have to meet 10,000 clients, you know, in 6 hours, leaving you completely exhausted and spent. And we met some, I don't believe of speaking ill of people, we met some people that were not equipped to have the word marketing on their business card. And it was hard. It was hard work. But, when I was relaying an earlier, anecdote, I suddenly remembered that we did also enjoy some success with just prospecting in the traditional way. And probably the most celebrated example of that was Friends Reunited, which for younger listeners, was the first social media platform in the UK and grew to 21 million UK members. So it was no mean feat and had never been done before. And anyway, they were already fairly successful. I think a startup that had already acquired about 5 million members when we met them. They were written about in the newspapers. You and I spotted this opportunity. We decided that we'd write to them. You wrote them one of the funniest and most audacious letters I've ever read, because it basically just had the word blah in it, repeated about 150 times. The new marketing director that we'd read about in the newspaper. And that's the other thing that we did, is we read lots of newspapers, as was, and always tried to stay abreast of who was moving where and perhaps what we could say to them or how we might interest them in how we could help them solve their problems. They'd acquired a management team, new management team with a new marketing director. His name was Tim. We wrote him a letter, which in fact you wrote, and it said, "Dear Tim, I almost wrote you the most boring letter in the world, the one that went," and you then replicated the word blah about 100 times, blah, 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 blah. But every 2 or 3 lines it had a word in. So it's blah, 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 agency. Blah, 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 blah. Very creative. Blah, 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 blah. We have lots of services. Blah, 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 blah. And that carried on until the final paragraph that said, "But instead of writing you a letter like that, we're just going to say something along the lines of, you know, you've joined a fantastic brand and we've got tons of ideas for how you can make it even more successful." When we eventually did meet him, there's a whole anecdote in that, because he wanted the prospect meeting whilst walking down the embankment, even though we had laid out our boardroom with biscuits and London's finest tea. But he wanted the prospect meeting to involve you and I walking down the street with him, which we did. We eventually, we won the account. We started going there. They were above a hairdresser's in Oxted, I think it was. And he showed us what he had been sent by other agencies, which included things like an entire classroom desk, like an old school classroom desk with a liftable lid. You put your pens and your papers and your apple and your catapult or whatever inside. And that was just one example of someone who had lifted an entire desk and put their credentials inside and sent it to them. And all sorts of other magazines and pop-ups and posters and blah, 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 because they were already, you know, a newsworthy organization and therefore desirable to work with. And we had sent them a letter that just had the word blah, with a unit cost of, you know, the stamp and the piece of paper, which goes to show there's a story in there somewhere about creativity.
Yes,
right?
There is. there is, absolutely. He was an unusual client. He was quite an eccentric character in his own right. And I think it just was perfect for him, wasn't it? And he'd been in a number of other positions, and I think he was just bored with kind of contrived creativity. And I wrote a letter that made him laugh. And I read somewhere recently, I think it was Gloria Steinem said that laughter is the only unforced emotion. You can't fake it. And it's true. You can't. I know that you're a trained actor, Mark, but even the best actors.
But I'm not a trained comedian, as you probably know.
But it's true. You know, it's genuine. Laughter is genuine, and you can hear it if it isn't. And making him laugh, that was just the best possible response.
No, actually, you're right. Because I was going to say to you, what we offered him was really what any prospective client wants, which is we said we had some ideas to how to make his brand better or build his membership base. And obviously what they want is ideas. But actually, maybe I'm guilty of a massive error of post-rationalization because you're right, we just moved him. Maybe. That was it.
Well, I've always said, one of the things that I've frequently said, probably in your hearing, is that emotion comes before reason in all matters to do with advertising. I don't think I'm giving utterance to an original thought there. I just think it's very clear. But you have to remind yourself of that and, more importantly, remind your clients. And I'm going to podcast later about how clients try to stuff their briefs full of 101 reasons why you should buy something. And reasons just don't work. You and I know that. You need to, if you don't get the emotional connection, nothing else will work.
There's a famous black American novelist. Her name's eluding me for a second. Who wrote a little maxim that concluded with, "But they will always remember how you make them feel."
Yeah, it's Maya Angelou.
There you go.
Yeah, she says they won't remember what you wrote, they won't remember what you said, but they will always remember how you made them feel. And it's perfect, beautiful truth. Yeah, that's a whole other podcast that's just been destroyed now because I was definitely going to do
really,
one about it. No, I'm undeterred. I'm going to do it.
Yeah, do it anyway.
It's so important and it's so easily lost. Anyway, so that was prospecting. And then you've kind of talked already about pitching, but I think we did. My memory was actually that we won 18 in a row, but it may have been 15 or 18 or something like that. But I always felt there were two things about that. One was you have to do a lot of pitches because that gets you good at it. I mean, marketing people are very fond of sporting analogies, but there is something about being match fit. And we had a really slick kind of, we were fit. We were pitching a lot and we were, once we started winning, we were very capable of recreating that feeling in ourselves that you need to have going into pitch. And I think when you said enthusiasm earlier, I think that is so important. It's infectious. People catch it from you. And that enthusiasm that you have for what you're going to do with their brand makes them enthusiastic all over again about their brand.
Yes.
Something like that anyway.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I was going to say earlier, when we were talking about the importance of sort of diversity on the team, it's teams that win new business. I've got no doubt about it at all. That's what you need for a great pitch. I'm sure there are instances of David Abbott, or indeed you, walking into a room, standing, reading some great copy and kind of winning it there and then. But I think by and large, agency clients pick teams. As we know, they don't even always pick the work they want to run, which statistically, you know, the majority of work that's pitched never actually runs. So somewhere they're picking a team, they're picking a group of people to go on a journey with.
Yeah, the team. I think I've already possibly said something about this on another occasion, but people by people is the thing that we swore by, which is, you know, encapsulates what you've just said. But I think it's very easy to, you know, ours is an industry full of people who like showing off. And it was when you go into a pitch and you're, rather than showing off about yourself, you're showing your enthusiasm for the client and their work and what they do, rather than drawing massive attention to yourself. That is so much more likely to win them over, I think. You know, there are just a lot of people in very expensive suits who are highly self-regarding in the business. I'm not criticizing our competitors, who are all lovely people, but we know that this is true. And I think some humility. I think the humility is another of the themes in all these podcasts. Some humility.
Humility
in the
was the other thing we were great at, wasn't it?
We're being very, very humble now in congratulating ourselves on our humility. There's going to have to be some serious editing here.
We were so humble. We were more humble than anyone.
We were the humblest. We were the most humble. Yeah, okay. Right, good catch. Thank you. Maybe I'll leave that in. All right, come on then.
Yeah.
So there we are, pitching. What else?
Yeah.
Remind me what else is on the list.
Leadership. I remember talking to you about an idea that you had that rocked my mind a bit, because I was in my early 30s, probably a little bit full of myself, very much believed in the kind of charismatic leader model. I remember you saying to me that you thought it was leadership, one should see leadership as a resource. And the first time you said that to me, I remember literally not being able to compute the sentence. It's like, hey, what? A resource? And that seems a bit dull. But I grew over time to understand that there are times when you need to lead from the back, particularly if you wanted to grow future leaders. And I've worked with many people and many leaders and now many creative directors as well. And I would say amongst the number of things that you are uniquely good at, one of them is spotting and developing and making space for leaders.
Thank you.
But it talks to this point about at the times needing to see leadership as a resource in order to equip people, giving them the room to grow, giving them the opportunity to grow. And certainly that was one of the aspects of leadership that comes to mind when I think a bit about our agency.
Yeah, I remember talking to you about that, right? And I do think that. I think the leadership can be interpreted by people in all kinds of ways, and a lot of them are really bad because it, you know, people strut around and feel terribly important. But if it's done right, it is absolutely a resource for everyone else.
And I think much of what we're talking about now is really about the preconditions for growth. And this is something that I've thought about a lot in recent years, because actually, whether it's new business or whether it's people, at some level, it comes to the same thing, which is leadership is about creating the context for growth and encouraging the growth of one's people and new business. And the last topic we discussed, for me, are actually intimately connected, because here's the hypothesis I put to you.
Okay.
Which is, if you find good people, one of the determinants of good people, we always said, was their innate curiosity. You would ask people, for example, what novel they were reading or what book they were reading in an interview, which people would often remark about, wow, I wasn't expecting that. Because it's not, you know, it's not the usual thing that one's asked. But, you know, it was a clue about what you valued, and it allowed people with an imagination or a sense of innate sense of curiosity to let us know. So you start with the right raw material. You find people who are curious to grow, and then you put them in an environment where you encourage them to grow. You actively encourage it by, you know, giving them opportunities that they might not have had before, by introducing them to source material they might not have had before, talking about films, talking about books, talking about popular culture. You know, anything is material, potential material for creative inspiration, is it not? And then when they grow, they encourage their colleagues to grow. And then when they do that, what tends to happen is that they have better ideas and they share those ideas with their clients. And then their clients grow. And then when their clients grow, guess what happens? The agency grows. And then you have this sort of virtuous circle where everything and everyone is in growth. Now, that may seem a little rose-tinted in present economic circumstances in particular, because we are apparently poised to enter a recession if we're not already in it. But nevertheless, you know, I think it's important that we recognize that we're, you know, we're in a what a client described to me as a once-in-a-hundred-year storm right now, and it will pass. However violent that storm is, however long it lasts, and this notion, this truth about growth and its connection, the notion that it starts from within and then it kind of emanates outwards, and that our job as leaders is to create the context for growth. And that context is not just about creating the environment. That context is about having a really clear sense of purpose. We were very clear about why we set up a business and what we wanted to achieve with it. And it had clear financial objectives, but it wasn't just about money. We were really clear about what we wanted to see people do. We were really clear about what our narrative was. We stood up every month and we told a version of that narrative a million times so that you and I could recite it in our sleep, as could our other partners. And we, you know, we valued and rewarded the people who showed that kind of behavior, and they, you know, they repaid it it reaped dividends with their clients who grew. We won, you know, multiple awards, every source of recognition going, and we had created a cycle of growth or a circle of growth.
We had. And I would only add one thing to that, which is the growth of the people in the business was not at each other's expense, but it was complementary. And we, and I think that's important to say, just because
It's additive, isn't it?
Right. Thank you. It is additive, absolutely. And we occasionally hired people who'd come from more traditional agencies, and I'm thinking particularly of very old-fashioned ad agencies, and they were pretty much broken by the way they'd been treated. And we all know the stories about creative directors brutalizing their departments and what have you, and we've seen it done. And in that, those kind of people would come in and think, hang on, aren't I supposed to kind of tread on everyone else's head to get where I want to be? And we would just very gently, I don't think we even had to say it, we just, that wasn't the way we worked. Nobody had to stand on someone's head. Everyone was going to grow together. And when people had ideas, we'd listen to them all. And it was once described, as you remember, as communism. But it wasn't that. It was participation. And to use the overworked word, empowerment.
No, you're absolutely right. And there's a risk even in this conversation that we are sort of being, we're bordering on nostalgia, because of course there were times, I'm sure, where people had a crappy time or it didn't work out for them, or they were hired full of promise and, you know, then left months later, sooner than they wanted, etc. You know, we weren't perfect, but I think we did manage to create an environment at our best, which was in ideas terms, meritocratic. That's exactly why that person said this is communism. Lots of businesses talk about the power of the collective, the importance of, you know, of numerous minds rather than just one, all expressed slightly differently about the fact that a good idea can come from anywhere. But creating a culture, that's a word that I haven't used yet in this conversation, but creating a culture in which that becomes possible, not just possible, but desirable, is not easy to achieve. Obviously, other businesses have done it, other agencies have done it. You know, there are, if you look at the most successful agencies when we were in business together and the most successful agencies now, that continues to be the truth, which is they have created a culture in which some of the things that we're talking about are possible, even desirable, and indeed championed.
Yes, of course. We were not unique. You're quite right. This shouldn't be an exercise in nostalgia. And one of the things that we might just point at right now is that in a recession, and you've just described it as a kind of once in a hundred years storm, times like this, there is pressure from all kinds of directions to not have that kind of nurturing culture and to not encourage individual growth so much, to get rid of the more experienced people in a business because they're expensive, and to generally try and speed everything up to meet clients' demands for more stuff at a much lower cost. And you have to be responsive to what your clients are demanding, but not at the expense, I would say, of sacrificing a carefully nurtured culture.
Indeed. And that's going to require great dexterity and judgment in the months to come, because we already know that, you know, the Chancellor will be phasing out furlough. We can see that companies are already letting go of staff who were furloughed. When I open my social media in the morning, it's full of talented people saying, I'm leaving company X after Y years. That is what happens in a recession. And making sure that it's done as humanely as possible, as intelligently as possible. These are the conundrums which boardrooms around the world, agency boardrooms around the world, are currently having to think through.
They are indeed. And it's obviously what we're going through now is unprecedented, and that word's been used far too frequently.
An unprecedented number of times it's been used.
Yes, it has. That's exactly right. But it's worth remembering one small thing, perhaps, that after the Second World War, which was also unprecedented and awful and dreadful, one of the great things that came straight after that in this country was the birth of the National Health Service and the welfare state that went with it. To which we owe, as we've all recently been acknowledging, pretty much everything. So out of terrible times, wonderful things can happen. And that must apply equally in the kind of on the small scale in marketing businesses as it does in the grander scale of things like the way whole societies can change and improve.
Well, and apparently, according to historians, this has always been the case, that some of the greatest periods of creativity have followed periods of austerity or difficulty or conflict. And I was thinking about this reason. Here's a question for you. I know you're the interviewer, but it's my turn for a minute. How does that observation about periods of blooming creativity following periods of great difficulty, how does that relate to the aphorism in our industry about the freedom of a tight brief, on the basis that sometimes when you have very little resource, when people talk about the freedom of a tight brief, they either mean that the proposition is beautifully honed, or they might mean that there's limited budget, or that you wish you could do a TV spot, but all you've got is just a single poster execution. What is that aphorism about, freedom of a tight brief? And does that relate to what we're talking about?
It does relate to it, I think. I mean, the reason that aphorism exists is, I think, that creative ideas, if they're completely unfettered, tend to go off in all kinds of directions and possibly end up going nowhere very useful at all. If we look for a moment at other art forms, we can see that in some of the greatest creative works of all time have worked within very tight parameters. And it shows you, I think, that the creative mind does very well when it has a kind of a frame within which to work and borders up against which you can then bounce. So if you think about, obviously, Shakespeare, five acts, that was the rule for his plays and his sonnet cycle. Sonnets are extremely disciplined forms. It really challenges the creative mind to do better, I think, when there are those kind of constraints. And if you think about what appear to be very free form types of creative expression, I was reading the other day an account in a book by Tim Harford, The Undercover Economist. He's written a book called Messy, which is all about how messy things lead to greater creativity. And one of the first anecdotes is about Keith Jarrett.
Mm.
Now, you know,
jazz musician.
Absolutely. Jazz pianist, produced an album called the Cologne Concert, which is fantastic. And it appears to be Keith Jarrett just sitting down at the piano and doing whatever he feels like. It actually turns out to be the case that the piano that he was supplied with was very far short of his requirements and had some real problems with the sound at the top end and some of the notes were sticking and what have you. So it presented him with a series of creative constraints and he worked with it. I mean, he almost refused to perform, but when he did perform, he had to adapt and constrain his improvisation using what the piano was capable of. So in that sense, he had a tight brief because he had a piano that just wouldn't do some of the things he'd normally want to do.
There you go.
And it pushed him to produce one of the best-selling albums of all time, certainly one of the best-selling jazz albums.
Beautiful example. And you've managed to segue onto our next topic, the next topic being life outside of work. Well, certainly how you had framed it. So life outside of work, for me, has always involved copious amounts of music. In fact, I took half an hour out just to scribble some notes and mentally prepare for this conversation earlier and put on a jazz album as an American saxophonist called Joshua Redman. And it just helped get me in the mood. So, I mean, I guess to a creative director, knowing you as I do, that would be about the diversity of inputs. And how important it is to effectively have a varied diet, would it not?
yes, it would, Mark. It would, absolutely. And you have to be open to all kinds of things. And open is the key word here. So you don't just listen to the things you've always listened to, go to the places that you've always gone to, which I think is a slight danger in our kind of over-curated world, that, you know, recommendations from algorithms and other people take the place of going out and opening your eyes and ears to whatever else might be going on. But yeah, you need to be thoroughly absorbent of everything. Music is incredibly important because it taps straight to the emotions. it doesn't, you can't say what music's actually saying. It can't be defined in that way, but you do know what it makes you feel. So we could go right back to Maya Angelou there and say, we know how music makes us feel. And it has an interesting effect, as you've just observed, on the mind and gets you into a specific kind of mood. But I would say, yeah, that's one thing. And then there are all manner of other things. And we're very fortunate in London when we are free to go. We have, when we're allowed to go into the galleries and the theatres and all the other places where the cultural life of London is carrying on, or hopefully will be carrying on again. But it's even broader than that. And Chalice and I talked in a recent podcast about Cash for Culture and how there was a bit of a debate about somebody wanting to go to a boxing match. But I would say, yeah, absolutely, that's another. Yeah, why not?
Opportunism, I think, actually.
No, I just disagree with that, because I think it's a cultural phenomenon. Now, you may not...
Yeah, no. Listen, you're absolutely right. And actually, which great American, was it Norman Mailer, who was famously into watching boxing? So, I mean, in all seriousness, I fundamentally support that. And I think it's desperately important. And actually, I'll continue to quote you for a bit, since I'm now the interviewer, which is, you once said that a desk is a dangerous place to view the world. And always encouraged, well, always did this yourself, and therefore encouraged in others to go out and expose themselves to as many diverse inputs as possible, including the, you know, overhearing conversations in the laundrette or on the bus, our consumers effectively talking about using our products or living their lives. You know, it explains why you refused to subscribe to Campaign and Marketing and instead used your budget to subscribe to New Scientist and the Times Literary Supplement, which I think is quite totemic, or at least illustrative, of a desire to learn, to seek inputs from others. I always read business books. You always read literature. You always argued that you would learn more from a work of fiction than I could learn from a business book. The truth is, we were both right.
Of course.
But there's another point here, which is not just about kind of diversity of inputs on the basis that we need to be students of all aspects of life. But I think it's also got a very contemporary significance as well, Paul, because our industry has been shaken, like many other industries, in the last couple of months around the topic of Black Lives Matter. And the recognition that actually we fish from too small a pool as creative businesses around the world, when in fact we should be way more diverse. We should be leading the way compared to other types of businesses. If you diversify your talent base, then more diverse people inputs will also lead to more diverse and interesting outputs. So, you know, as somebody that runs a major Jewish organization in London, I'm of course sensitized to questions of anti-racism, but the racism that my black friends and colleagues are suffering is a different kind of racism, and it would be wrong to equate the two, but they are both forms of hatred, and diversity in the broadest sense of the word of course needs to include diversity when it comes to gender, just as it does around, you know, ethnic groups and nationality, though each of those issues has their own dynamic, and one would never seek to somehow rank one above the other. Nevertheless, they are all issues we need to take seriously, given that we are fundamentally people businesses. And so having diverse, inspired, interested, liberated workforce is desperately important if we want to stay relevant. And that notion of relevance has never been more apposite for the creative industries, because if we're going to go through a tough time, or if we are going through a tough time where clients can perhaps do the work themselves or just hire a freelance resource and do it themselves, where, you know, agencies have got to earn and re-earn their right to trade every single day, potentially reinvent themselves, think really carefully about their business models and take nothing for granted, then all of this comes into play.
Yeah, we do. As you put it, we fished in too small a pond, and that's something the whole marketing industry needs to sort out, and quick. What else have we got on our list? I've completely lost track of this now.
As I was preparing for this conversation with you, I thought a little bit about what I learned from my partners, because I didn't actually know Kit Kat, Alexander, or even Shaw that well. And then suddenly I find myself kind of in a boat, as it were, with four people, you know, living and breathing and sharing and sometimes fighting and charting our course together. And it's in the years that followed, maybe this is just age, maybe this is just what happens and how wisdom accumulates. I've thought a lot about what I learned from each of you. So I thought I'd talk to you about
it. Well, I would be very, very interested to hear it. I can contribute, no doubt. But what you're saying is we didn't know each other that well when we got together. What we did know, I think, was what you referred to earlier, which is that we were very different kind of people. I had known Jeremy for a year and Vonnie for a year. I hadn't really met you at all. So we got to know each other in the kind of crucible of also starting up that agency. So go on then. What did you learn from...
What did I learn from each of you? Well, funny enough, I started writing down some Kit Kat aphorisms and I stopped at about number 15.
Oh, really?
And I thought, bloody hell. Yeah, yeah. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, first of all, some of them aren't yours. You've stolen them. Of course. I didn't realize this, you know, at the tender age I was, sort of 20 years ago when we set this business up. I thought you were just a genius. Didn't realize you just read a lot of books.
Right, thank you. Yes.
Well, I've got to prick the bubble before I pay you a compliment. But a whole bunch of things from, you know, walking as the route into the subconscious thinking to incubation, as in thinking about things overnight. In fact, I thought I'll pick that one for a second. So the understanding the role of the subconscious in the creative process, something that's kind of been well documented. And I obviously came to understand the importance of that if I didn't already. I also understood the importance of incubating a strong thought in one direction or another. In other words, the notion of sleeping on it. And I read a fascinating book a few months ago, which I think has become something of a minor bestseller, by Matthew Walker, and it's called something like Why We Sleep. And suddenly thought of you, because he talked about the role of kind of unconscious processing whilst we were sleeping. So it transpires a whole load of really important things happen whilst we sleep. One is that when we sleep and we effectively stop thinking consciously, our brain is able to make sense of things in a way that it couldn't whilst we were awake. So making connections, perhaps, between what we knew and what we now do, or somehow just allowing a bit of perspective. So I've thought a lot over time about the notion of creative incubation, about the role of the unconscious, and in fact, just the importance in day-to-day life, in relationships and everything else, of not acting on first instinct and just sleeping on it. And then I guess there'll be one other I pick from the very, very long list of poor Kit Kat aphorisms. And this is simply because this one attaches to a story. So though there are lots of very telling phrases that emanated from you, including you can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into in the first place, which I've often found to be true. The other one that I wanted to pick was your analogy about skiing through trees. So we turned up at a business that had acquired us. They merged us with another business. That business had suffered for a few years. It wasn't doing so well. The people there felt a little downtrodden. I'm deliberately kind of not naming names because it's the context that's important here, which is they suddenly found up that they turned up for work one day and they had new leaders, and it was us. And we stood up and we gave a town hall, as they now fashionably call them, and we told them what our vision was and how we wanted to lead things and how we rolled. And you told the story of how to ski through trees, which I think should now come from you since it's your story.
It is my story. I should preface this by saying that I don't know much about skiing. I was told this by someone else. Skiing through trees is an incredibly dangerous thing because you're going at high speed and there are these large objects that if you hit them, they don't give. There's no give in a tree. So skiing through trees is tricky. And the worst thing that you can do is look at the trees. You've got to look at the gaps between them. The only way that you can do it is look at the gaps, because where you look is where you're going to go. And that was the point of the story, really. Where you focus is where you will end up. So don't look at the obstacles that we are aware are all around us and in our path. Look at the open space between them, aim at that, and keep aiming at that, because then you will find your way through to where you really want to be. That was the point of that story.
And I found in the that was told circa 2011 is when we stood up together and you told that story. And I found in the almost decade since that to be so true in so many aspects of my life. So, you know, it is true that apparently optimists live longer than pessimists. And certainly, you know, we are all drawn to optimistic people. We like to know that there's a way through things, be it, you know, the COVID, Donald Trump, other politicians I could refer to, but I won't. You know, that better times are ahead. And of course, in business, all the time, this kind of stuff happens, right? You have a tough time, you lose a pitch, you lose an account. In one's personal life, unfortunately, as one gets older, you know, one sees bereavement and one sees suffering. And yet there is also beauty in life, you know, and there is opportunity and, you know, there is symphony. And the truth is that if you focus on the symphony rather than the cacophony, life becomes a little cheerier. Life becomes a little more worth living. It's just true in life. It's true in relationships too, because of course, you know, we are imperfect. Our relationships, therefore, being projections of ourselves are imperfect. And if we want to focus on somebody else's weaknesses or indeed our own, then there's plenty of food for thought and we can argue about them all day long. But if we focus on our strengths and the strengths of our business partners, in this case, or indeed the people that we work with, you want to get the best out of an employee, then, you know, that's perhaps what you want to be doing is promoting people's strengths or to use a slightly different metaphor. Figuring out where people cast light rather than when they cast shadow. Jeremy, of course, who was the uncle or the grandfather, or use whichever family analogy you want. I think you always described him as slightly Eeyore-ish, in that he would always be the first person to point out why this amazing new account that we'd won would never work out and we'd lose the business within months. Or this new talent that we'd all hired and we were desperately excited by was actually a very flawed individual and they'd be gone within weeks. And of course, sometimes he was right. But actually, gags aside, you know, he was an incredibly intelligent man. And that was the first thing that, you know, that struck me when I first met him. This was a very, very, very clever man, who was also, very wise and very human. And so he taught me a lot about business fundamentals. You know, in the broadest sense, that all that glitters is definitely not gold, and how to sort the wheat from the chaff, and how one shouldn't get too excited too quickly because things can go wrong. So a bit of reflection, and Vonnie too, also very, very different, to me. She has a passion that is difficult to match. That passion was often directed at clients with an absolutely kind of, an absolutely monomaniacal focus on clients and client needs, and being client oriented, which was arguably essential in a client partner, which is what her job was. But she brought that focus to the table. She was also very focused on people as well, and staff. And therefore, no surprise now that she's become a very accomplished coach, leadership coach. And she also had a directness, despite the fact that I am the son of two immigrants. Nevertheless, my mother was quite kind of Victorian, albeit if you can say that about a French person. And therefore, I'd sort of learnt to be quite careful in how I said things. And Vonnie was often refreshingly and sometimes very challengingly, when it came to you and I, frank with us. She said it like it was. She told it directly. And it was, though not always easy, it was something I have, or it is something that I have grown to love and respect. That she told you exactly what she thought and where she was coming from, so that you had no doubt about her position on things. We were going to talk a little bit about advertising versus direct marketing, and principally because after having set up one of the better direct marketing agencies, I then had to follow my instincts and go and work in advertising. Principally because we'd spent so much time slagging it off, Paul. So much time telling clients that they were wasting their time talking to advertising agencies because, you know, actually we had the answer. Now, two things to share with you there. One is I came to understand and appreciate, particularly when running an advertising agency, that advertising is an immensely powerful force. It's quite a blunt force. Nowhere near as precise as perhaps what we were doing, but it is an immensely powerful one in building kind of market share and consideration for products. And though I could now mount a defense of advertising and explain to you why perhaps some of the things we said back there were wrong. I'm far more inclined to say, actually, often what we were selling, Paul, was advertising. We just didn't call it that. And your fundamental belief that the first thing we need to do is move people is exactly the same as what happens when advertising is effective. It connects people with people at an emotional level. They post-rationalize their decision after the event. And we since know from neuroscience, particularly in the last decade, that that is how long-term memory structures are built, by connecting with people emotionally. You only have to think about how a whole bunch of memories flood back from a song when you listen to a song that you first heard 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, depending on your age. And that's how great advertising works. It connects with people at a more fundamental level, and it kind of somehow builds that kind of unconscious preference, and it does it at scale. So I think it's a question, like so many other things in life are, of and rather than or. It's not advertising or direct marketing. It's not brand or response. It's both. And we knew it instinctively at the time, but of course we had a product to sell, so we were going to sell it with as much vigor and passion. And we were also determined to show advertising agencies who had a kind of a sloppy sense of superiority for a few decades that they had no reason to feel superior, because so we had very, very smart colleagues and a very good product. So we had absolute right to believe in ourselves. And I wanted just to share a final memory with you, if I may.
Go ahead.
Of a meeting that we had with Samsung in our then boardroom, where, as is the, in this case, the Korean way, but as we know, our Japanese colleagues when we worked on Lexus were the same, that there was a tradition at the time of passing on business cards, often held with both hands, you know, squeezed at the thumbs, and then passing and exchanging. And our illustrious and very senior client that visited us from Samsung came to bid you farewell at the end of the meeting, clutching a business card. So you, for once, actually remembered your business cards, and you grabbed one and you clutched it in your two hands. You were literally twice his height. And he bowed and passed you his business card, and you bowed and you passed him your business card. And he said to you words which I will now also echo, which is, "Mr. Kit Kat, I will never forget you."
Thank you for that. I thought you were going to tell the story of the Samsung meeting, which I wasn't in, but I was told about, where one of the junior Samsung clients said something and the senior client didn't like what he said and walked around the table and hit him on the back of the head.
I don't think I was in that one. I would have remembered
it. I wasn't. Sav told me about it afterwards. It's like, oh my God, that's not, is that even, are we allowed to host a meeting where that happens?
Or is that, it was one way of disagreeing. Yeah. But actually, on a more positive cultural note, the first time we experienced the chairman, I think the UK chairman of Lexus, push his chair back from the table, shut his eyes and have a quick nap. And we were rather disconcerted because we thought, well, we'd obviously spectacularly failed to impress him. And we were assured by the client afterwards that that's a sign of confidence in Japan, which there's obviously a story there about cultural diversity and not taking anything for granted.
Yeah, there is indeed. Well, yeah, Lexus. Okay, well, that we have much to learn, Grasshopper, don't we?
Indeed we do. Indeed we do.
Much to learn indeed. Thank you very much, Mark. That was great. I think there are some useful pearls of wisdom there from you in particular about starting up KitKat nor Alexander Shaw and turning it into what was in its day one of London's most successful agencies. Thanks again. I hope everyone enjoyed listening to it. And if you did, please tell everyone else, give us a rating on your podcast app and tune in for the next one. Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
168 Things We've Learned About Creative Marketing and We Think You'll Find Useful to Know is a series of podcasts created by Paul KitKat and Chalice Croke. Production was by William KitKat, who also wrote the theme music. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe. See you soon. Bye.